Hi, good morning, and welcome to the Daisy Take. I'm your host, Daisy Elizabeth, where your suspicions grow. And I want to welcome you here. If you're new here, hi and welcome. And I hope that you hit that subscribe button and never miss an episode or that little check mark. And if you've been listening, thank you so much, and I appreciate you sticking with me. Information for today's podcast comes from Wikipedia.org and Oxygen.com. This episode contains subject matter that may be sensitive to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. So today we're going to talk about the yogurt shop murders. Here lately I've been on a kick on the Daisy Take of, you know, actors or actresses that famous people that kill themselves or shoot themselves in the head or, you know, have suicidal tendencies. And I really really wonder about that. So I've really been on that kick, and it's usually from the 60s to the 70s. There's so many of them. It's ridiculous. But I found this article that was sent to me. My daughter sent it to me. And I really wanted to do it because it really intrigued me. It is just sad. It's sad. It's just so sad. It happened in Austin at a place called, I can't believe it's yogurt. December 6th, 1991. And the victims were four teenage girls, 13-year-old Amy Ayers, 17-year-old Eliza Thomas, 17-year-old Jennifer Harbison, and Jennifer's 15-year-old sister, Sarah. You know what the sad thing is that family lost two daughters in one day. It's sad for all of them. You lose one, that's devastating. But losing two on the same day? So these girls, two of them worked at the yogurt shop, and two of them were the sister and the friend, and they were waiting for them to get off work. And Jennifer and Eliza were employees of the shop, while Sarah and her friend Amy were at the shop getting a ride home with Jennifer after it closed at 11. Now, about 1 hour before closing time, a man who had tried to hustle customers was permitted to use the toilet, but took a very long time, and he may have jammed the rear door. That's what they're thinking. A couple who left the shop just before 11, when Jennifer locked the front door, reported seeing two men at a table, like acting very strangely. Like she went there and that's the part that I couldn't understand. So I'm trying to envision it in my mind. She goes and the couple leaves. She locks the door, but there's still two men at the table. Maybe she didn't see them. I'm really not sure. Now around midnight, a patrolman was passing by and he saw a fire in the shop. And first responders discovered the bodies of the girls inside. The victims had been shot twice in the head. And you have to, let's look back and look at their ages. Okay. Very, very, very young little girls. They'd been shot in the head. And at least one of them had been raped. A .22 and a .380 pistol were used to commit the murders. And they probably exited through the back door. Now, the back door was found unlocked. The front door was found locked. So, there must have been an organization to control the victims and destruction of evidence by arson. And that's why it was set on fire. Now, Austin Police Department has unknown DNA from an unknown male has DNA from an unknown male. And it's just, oh my God, this whole case is just so sad. That's why I wanted to do it. As a result of one of the rapes, a Y chromosome matched the perpetrator DNA and has been found in the research database of the FBI. But it has declined to reveal the identity of the man. So I guess if you're involved in a violent crime, they take your DNA and they match it up to, and I don't know if in 91 they had that technology, because I know that DNA and everything was very new at that time. I believe that DNA actually started with the OJ case, OJ Simpson case. So I believe that DNA, I'm not sure if it was really developed back then, but I do believe they did, you know. Now, thousands of men could bear this fragment of DNA, and that's unable to identify individuals. So each had been shot in the head with a .22 caliber lead bullet. Sarah's hands had been bound behind her with a pair of panties. She also had been gagged and raped. Jennifer was not bound, but her hands were behind her back. Eliza had been gagged with her hands also tied behind her back. And three had been severely charred and shot in the back of the head. Now, unlike the others, Amy's body was found in a separate part of the shop. She was not charred, but had received third-degree burns, which is like 25 to 30% of her body. I believe that it was almost like she was crawling away, like she was trying to get away. I think that that's why she was found separate from the other girls. Now, she had been shot as the same as the others. However, the bullet had missed her brain. She also had a second bullet, which caused severe damage to her brain. Exiting through her lateral cheek and jawline. Now, initially, investigators had produced a large number of persons of interest. Among them, a 15-year-old caught with a .22 caliber, but it was not established as the murder weapon. And that was in a nearby mall days after the killing. So that was in a mall days after the killing, and he was caught with that gun. Although he initially gave promising information, after tough questioning, the detectives decided he was trying to get himself out of the gun charge and eliminate him and his three petty criminal friends who none of them were older than 17 at the time. Now, several years later, a new detective on the case theorized that four teens from 1991 were credible suspects. And by that time, they were in their 20s. They interrogated them, you know, and that had been conducted by various detectives, and confessions were obtained. They said all four, Robert Springsteen, Michael Scott, Maurice Pierce, and Forrest Wellborn, had participated in the murder. Now, no record was kept of what was said to the men in 1991 interrogations, making it impossible to know whether the detectives had supplied information to the suspects in the initial interrogation. I think, I don't want to say this case was just, maybe it wasn't ruined from the beginning. I don't know if that's the right word, but it sounds like when they had a fresh pair of eyes on it, they just kind of like came up with other, you know, things that were going on. So two of the four were sent to trial, and this was due to their self-incriminating statements. And the prosecution, of course, went into great detail, presented hard evidence. And no, I'm sorry, they had no hard evidence except for what the two men had said. One being sentenced to death and the other being sentenced to life in prison because he had been 15 at the time. The prosecution's tactics of using experts of each one's alleged confession and the other's trial was ruled a violation and violated the confrontation clause. I've never heard of the confrontation clause. But I guess that there is something like that, or at least there should be. Because the co-defendant was not testifying, both convictions were overturned. The men were freed in 2009. So if everything was burned and these guys, even if they said they did it, blah, 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 they were convicted, they were sent to jail, but then they got out of jail because they really didn't have any evidence. Like, they tried to burn, and a lot of the evidence that they did have was burned at the crime scene. So all the evidence that they needed, that was all burned. So the prosecution abandoned plans for a retrial. And Texas courts later decided that those released were not entitled to compensation, as they had not proven they did not commit a crime. Now, I guess if you prove that you didn't commit a crime, you can be entitled to compensation, probably under Texas law. Hector Polanco had been accused of coercing false confessions in a previous notorious case involving exonerated defendants Christopher Ochoa and Richard Danziger. Both were released from prison after 13 years in prison. And Danziger was assaulted in prison, which resulted in permanent brain damage. Seven jurors from the trial have stated they would not have convicted Scott and Springsteen since there had been no evidence available at that time. So it was kind of just, it sounds to me like they were throwing a line out there and see what they could catch. Now, at the time of the killings, a known serial killer, Kenneth McDuff, was in the area. He had a history of multiple murders involving teenagers, but was soon ruled out. He was executed on November 17th, 1998. And I guess that there was a lot of false confessions and people coming forward saying they did it. I think that people do that because they want the notoriety. They want to be in the spotlight. They want their 15 minutes of fame. Why would you want to do something like that? If you want your 15 minutes of fame, do something positive in the world, not something negative. So, in 2006, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals overturned Robert Springsteen's conviction on the basis of an unfair trial. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to reinstate the conviction in February 2007. Now, on August 20th, 2008, this thing has been going on, and it's already 2008, okay? Lawyers for Scott and Springsteen requested DNA testing of alternate suspects. No matches against evidence discovered earlier in that year were found. So, you know, I mean, it just went on and on and on, even in through 2009. This case has not been solved, to my knowledge. And I think it's really sad that they haven't solved it. I guess they did seek DNA testing. And I guess if it would have been their DNA, they would be in prison right now. So the police office of Austin and the DA's office, I guess, you know, their further investigation continue to be a priority, finding the right person. However, they just haven't found them yet. In October 28th, 2009, all charges were dismissed against Scott and Springsteen. Now, on December 23rd, 2010, Austin Police Officer Frank Wilson and his rookie partner, Bradley Smith, conducted a traffic stop on a vehicle driven by Maurice Pierce in the northern part of the city. Pierce struggled with Wilson before removing a knife from his belt and stabbing Wilson in the neck. Wilson, who survived his injuries, pulled out a gun and shot Pierce. So these guys were, you know, they were bad from the word go. They were just bad guys. And they were bad teenagers and they were bad guys. And that just goes to show you. And on February 5th, 2022, it was announced that advanced DNA technology was bringing investigators closer than ever to solving the crime. I don't know if they did solve it. I really couldn't find anything. And on August 3rd, 2022, President Joe Biden signed the Homicide Victims' Families Rights Act into law, which was motivated by the yogurt shop murders. Now, this law is intended to help and ensure that federal law enforcement reviews cold case files and applies latest technologies and investigation standards. The logistics are not clear in the bill. However, it states that you can request, and a request can be made for a cold case review by federal agencies. So I really just want to say to these young girls, I hope that you are resting in peace. I'm sorry that your lives were taken so soon, Amy, Eliza, Jennifer, Sarah. It's really sad because they were so young and there was two daughters taken away from one family. And the other parents lost family members as well. And it's just really sad. So I hope that you rest in peace. And I pray that they find your killers. I want to thank you for joining me today on the Daisy Take. I hope that you have a wonderful weekend. Join me for Murdered and Missing Monday. Be kind to one another. And if you want to leave a review, head on over to Apple Podcasts. You can leave a free review. Just be kind with your words. Be kind to one another. Love you. Bye.